All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. Yeah, we are jamming today. I got a boat full of people just sitting here right away, okay? They just came in, and they're chattering, and they're angry, and they're standing up, and they're saying, we've got to be on now! So I'm going to put them on first. But first, I want to let you know that at the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Luna, a UCLA student, and someone who also works with Refuse Fascism, and we're going to be talking about making UCLA a sanctuary campus and a campus of resistance, okay? Before that, we'll be talking with Juan Demetrix, who's one of the concerned students, 1867 at Howard University, and they are protesting the university's collaboration with and sucking up to Donald Trump, including University President Wayne Frederick, who was part of a group of leaders of historically black colleges and universities who posed for pictures with Trump and who actually played footsie with DeVos or whatever her name is. It's just too sickening to contemplate. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome, in one case at least, back to the show. But also everybody else who's here. I don't know if you, I think you've all been, this is the first time you've been here?
First time for me.
First time.
Okay, good. We have rules. But I'm very, very pleased to be welcoming the people from the Fountain Theater here in LA. And we're talking about, it's actor Bo Foxworth, Judith Moreland, director Michael, is it Michetti or McKetti?
McKetti,
okay. And co-producer Stephen Sachs. Stephen, welcome back, man.
Good to be here, as always.
Yeah, Steven's an old hand at this.
Oh, yeah.
He knows what button to push if you start, you have to be teased. Anyway, on a more serious note, I saw a play at the Fountain Theater a week ago, and it was just incredible. It was just an amazing, amazing piece of work, and it's called Building the Wall. And I'm not going to tell you what it's about. I'm going to ask somebody else to tell you what it's about. In fact, what I think I'll do is I'll ask Stephen first. Actually, will that be better? Or would you rather, you guys can pick. Stephen, you want
to work together.
Okay, yeah. Tag team. All right. Just tell people what it is, because I really want people to understand this is a tremendously important play that no one should miss and that people should really hear what it's about, because it actually says a lot of truth about what's in the world. And it's also something that you don't go home and just say, hey, that was cool. Can I get a beer, turn on TV? You go home and you want to talk. I went home with my wife and said, we got to talk right now. We got to talk. So it's, but that's it, because people are thinking, because the situation is so damn serious in the world today and here in this country. And that's what this play is about. So go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this new play, Building the Wall, is the kind of theater that definitely triggers conversation and dialogue with audiences after seeing it. It's a brand new play written by playwright Robert Schenken, who's a Tony Award winning and Pulitzer Prize winning playwright and screenwriter. He wrote Hacksaw Ridge. And this is an urgent new play that he's written that takes place in 2019, just 2 years from now. And it is a cautionary tale, an imagining of just what may happen in this country if the immigration policies of the current administration move forward. It takes place in a prison meeting room. It's a two-character play, and you meet the character of Rick, who has been convicted of a horrific crime that we learn more about through the course of the play. And he is being interviewed by Gloria, and her job is to get to the truth, because Rick has been forbidden to testify at his own trial at his own lawyer's advice. So this is Rick's one chance to tell the truth about what happened and the unrolling of this policy of rounding up immigrants and detaining them in the private prison system, and how that policy unraveled into a nightmare that is unimaginable.
And that's where we'll keep the whole description, because when you go beyond nightmare, I get worried that somebody's going to slip up and say, oh, yeah, and then it was about this. You can't do that in this play. You really have to do it.
Dance Michael, around the end.
Yeah. Michael, let's talk about your take on, you're the director of this, and were you familiar with the play? Were you familiar with the work? Were you familiar with the playwright's work?
Well, I certainly was familiar with the playwright's work. Robert Schenken is a really esteemed and respected playwright, and I've seen many of his works through the years, beginning with Kentucky Cycle, which was done many years ago at the Taper, and was my first exposure to him as a playwright. I had not been familiar with the play until Stephen and Simon Levy gave me a copy of it and said, might you be interested in this? Because, of course, the play was written so recently. Robert actually began writing it, wrote the first draft of it even prior to Trump winning the election, but in fear that that might happen. But even that was, October of last year. And I only received a copy of the script. Our first meeting about the play was 2 months before our opening. It happened so quickly. And immediately as I read the play, I realized how important and powerful it was. And as Stephen said, it is a cautionary tale. We also want it to be a call to action. We want people to be aware of the play presents a possible scenario of how each step from here could grow into the unthinkable. And we need to stop these acts before this is set into action. So there are a lot of things that the Fountain is also doing around the project to continue the dialogue and make sure that we don't go home all feeling depressed and suicidal, but take action, including the fact that the Fountain is putting in every program a postcard addressed to the White House, and there is an encouragement at the end of the show for everyone to write something, anything that they feel on whatever side of this issue they are, but to our president and continue to try to take action to prevent this.
Now, I didn't get one because I was going to put down, screw you, you Nazi dog. this is not right. Yeah, well, they should. They really should. All right, one more question for you, Michael, because this is something, too, that I got. You're talking about building the wall, and this has been a battle cry of Trump. You know, so it's really interesting that with the title of the play and then Trump's battle cry. But it takes on a whole different thing. There's a literal wall as well as the wall that's happening in people's minds. And I think that's really important in terms of that, because it basically building a wall permits all kinds of things to happen, atrocities in the name of protecting the innocent, all kinds of things to happen. What did you think about when you took this up as the director in relation to that?
Yeah, well, there's no question Robert uses a wall as a metaphor in the play a number of times, and actually the final images, which I won't give away, but talk about that as well. You know, it's absolutely true. The other thing that I think that Robert has done beautifully here is that he has articulated through humanizing these two characters, Gloria, who is a very liberal history professor, and Rick, who is a conservative Trump-voting Texan man, but he humanizes both of these characters. And one of the things that we discover in the course of the play is the kind of walls between these two camps that we have established. And it's very difficult because until we can really have the conversations, we will not heal that. And it's easy for any of us who feel strongly on one side or the other to look only at our point of view and not consider the other. And until we do consider what the other side wants and find the ways to heal those differences and come to an understanding, we will never be able to resolve this. So, of course, those of us who are fearful of Trump's policies are resisting. We are doing it through art. But the play is also trying to humanize and begin to tear down walls between people just in understanding as well, which I think is crucial.
You know, it's interesting because I got a part of the take I had on it was also this thing, though, that there was a breakdown in the course of the play in terms of a certain sense. But it was also, I have to tell you, Judith Moreland, I really liked your character. Not that I didn't like yours, Bo, but I liked your work.
So much more likable.
I know. But there's a thing, you know. Look, I don't want to normalize Trump. Look, we have to. There's no understanding of Trump except you're going to understand how this man, what threat he is to humanity. And to me, it's really important to get that.
I agree with that. I think that's crucial. But there's a difference between that and understanding the people who supported him, mm-hmm. and what the motivation was for that. I agree. We can't normalize Trump, mm-hmm. but he was speaking to people who were feeling disenfranchised in a way. And I think we need to understand that.
Right. No, I agree. And I think actually, although one thing, I'll tell you, Bo, there were a number of times I just felt like standing up and slapping you in the head.
Yeah, I felt the same way about myself.
I noticed you were doing that a lot on the show. No, but it's true. It's basically testimony to the power of the character that was created. But Judith, let's talk with you a little bit because, okay. And with both of you, I'll pose this to both of you because there's the two characters and there's a way that you're portrayed as so normal. On one level, you know, you're talking to each other. There's a normalcy that's going on there. But there's something very terrible and earth-shaking that each of you is carrying with them. And all this is done so matter-of-factly. And to a degree, there's almost a sense of understanding that develops around that in a certain sense. Let's talk about your characters and what they're carrying with them and how they're coming into this.
Well, when I read the first draft of the script, there wasn't a lot of backstory or information about Gloria. And in conversation with both Michael, Robert Schenken, the playwright, and Stephen Sachs, we talked about how important it was for Gloria, who is really, in a sense, the audience, the people who are, they see the play through me, trying to understand who Rick is. We all felt that there needed to be a sense of not only who Gloria was, but that even though she's liberal and probably her policies are shared by many in the audience, that she's not perfect, that she has her flaws, and that she has as maybe if not as many ideas about the other as Rick does, that she certainly does bring her preconceived notions into the room as well. And so Robert did such a beautiful job of writing a very specific backstory of why Gloria is a historian and why she is so interested in not only cataloging what Rick has done, but also trying to come to an understanding of why he makes the choices that he does. So kudos to Robert for doing that. Gloria is a flawed person, as we all are, and her preconceived ideas about Rick are challenged very early on in the play. The character of Rick says, "I'm not as dumb as you think." It turns out Rick tells a very long story about his father, because of healthcare issues, losing a lot of money and having to work. Rick talks about his people that he knows losing their homes. And these are all issues that Gloria relates to and has happened in her life as well. So what's so wonderful about it is that there is a consensus in the room of each of us seeing something in the other that we can relate to and that we identify with. And so it makes the conversation even more fraught when you start to see what our differences are.
I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with actors Beau Foxworth and Judith Moreland, director Michael Michetti, and co-producer Stephen Sachs of the important new play by Robert Schenken called Building the Wall. Now, Building the Wall is playing at the Fountain Theater in Los Angeles, where I saw it. But through the National New Play Network, it will be having a rolling premiere in at least five other cities around the U.S., including Washington, D.C., and you can get this to play in your city very, very easy. For more information and to find a performance near you or to find out how you can organize a performance where you live, contact the National New Play Network at nnpn.org. Once again, that's nnpn.org.
See, look, you also bring something into the room that needs to be there because it's, and I thought it was very interesting that you would do this, you know, and because you're a black woman and you bring a whole history that too often this country tries to bury, hide, prettify, mm-hmm. you know, all this stuff. And later I'm going to be talking with Howard students. And one of the things they're going up against is this whole effort to say, like, you know, look, all that's in the past now. It's not something that, look, this is something that it's one, it's not in the past. And two, it's something that really has to be dealt with. And it's something that Trump has been, I mean, look, that bastard is like, bam. He's like, he told the historic black college and universities, he said, well, we're moving you into the White House, but you ain't getting no money. You know, so it's like, and so it's like we're moving you in so we can keep an eye on you and have you do what we need to do. But there's a point of the history you carry with you that comes into this. It's not a bad thing, because I think it infuses you with an understanding of sort of the hell that can be unleashed against the whole people.
Well, I think so too, and I think it's again, it's interesting that Robert Schenken wrote the character to be a African American. That's specifically in the script, and I think it's just for those reasons. Here is a white male who spends a lot of time saying, what about me? Who talks for us now? Mm. And it's as an African-American, even watching what's happening in the world right now and people, Trump supporters, it's very ironic. And in a way, a lot of my black friends and I, we were like, my family were like, well, welcome to our side.
But also now you know it also doesn't like. Claim to be racist. I mean, he doesn't see himself that way. And it has opened up a whole can of something. I can't say, but you know, this deep-seated racism that has been existing for so long that has just sort of been bubbling underneath the surface, and Trump has allowed it to surface and come out, and these people feel they can now do and say things that were not acceptable.
Well, tell me that
a few years ago.
Yeah, and I thought, and actually, I just want to let people know again that we are talking with Beau Foxworth. All right, because I have to. I really want people to know who you guys are. Okay. And he's 6'9" and he's 450
I'm
pounds.
Massive.
Right. Anyway, the thing is what I got, because look, I grew up with a lot of the people that were like your character. You know, I grew up.
So did
very,
I.
Yeah. Okay. So I grew up in a very poor part of Philadelphia, and it was sort of a
when I was telling somebody once that we used to sit on the steps and we thought we were seeing fireworks, and it was actually all the skies would light up, you know, and it was actually the oil refineries blowing the gas out. It was like lighting up on all different colored lights. And then we had the amusement time was when the truck come down, the mosquito truck would come down the street spraying, you know, whatever DDT out the back, and we were running in it.
Yeah. Yeah,
right, exactly. So people remember that stuff. But there's, you know, which made us all very dumb. Okay? but the thing is that there is this thing, though, too, with not just, there wasn't, you know, I think this point about the entitlement that actually is concentrated in your character as well. You know, because, yes, your character has, look, there's a certain thing he doesn't like what he ends up having to do or the direction he's being pushed in. Mm-hmm. He's moved to tears. But for a whole lot of what actually moved him into the Trumpian world was a sense of entitlement. Not just that I was getting screwed, but damn it, I don't deserve to be screwed. I have a right to this stuff. And it was sort of, it's very interesting the way that falls out.
Yeah, that sense that this is our country, the white people, the Christian man, is, I don't know where that's come out of. I mean, it's been there forever, I guess, but or as long as we've been here. But I think, you know, Rick is, I don't sense that entitlement from him in the working on this character, but that he was found himself in a place and in a position where he was forced into this place. But I mean, I have to see him from a different place. I'm trying to see him from a different, very opposite point of view from
you're looking
my
from
own,
the inside
yes.
out. Yeah.
And because it is so foreign to my way of thinking, mm-hmm. and my ideas and thoughts on this, and to have to put myself in that mindset has been extremely destructive.
I will say that Rick does make the argument that a lot of people who are in this country illegally are taking jobs that they could have. So that is something that, you know, within his argument, he makes the argument that, you know, why should people who are not here legally take jobs that no
white man wants to do anyway? I mean, nobody wants those jobs. Rick certainly wasn't going to do those
jobs. There's another place in the play where you talk about why don't I have the right to I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's something about defending white people and defending this.
Exactly.
Defending that.
Yeah.
You actually stage that as like, look, this is something, which look, this is what Trump has done. He's whipped up and molded a whole section of society that is, yes, they've been feeling the crunch since the steel mills have shut down and the good work is not there anymore. And they look around and damn, all them people are getting welfare, and even these people to come into this country, and they're being free medicine and all this stuff.
Who's
what the
looking
hell?
After the white guy?
Yeah,
anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very heavy because, and that's the interplay between you two is very, because there's that tension that's there that actually sort of, I think, helps to deepen the overall set of the play and the overall thrust of the play in terms of that tension that exists between you, even though you do have some kind of point where you're coming and you're talking to one another, and there's things that develop in your, you know, expression, your testimony, you know, that to Judith's character, you know, your testimony to her is sort of very, it's very moving, but it's still so much in a point where, I mean, look, a lot of Germans, even after World War II, didn't think they really did anything. Mm-hmm. Well, what? I had nothing to do with that. You know, come on. Which is something I sense, and I thought you guys really pulled it off, and the writing really pulled it off, too.
Yeah, I would just want to say, too, and add that, yes, the play is very much about a specific moment in history, and it's about now, and it's about this current administration and about Trump and these immigration policies. But it's also, I think, about something more than that and something deeper than that. And actually, Trump's name is not mentioned as much as you might think. It is about the current administration, but it's also about so much more. And that's what makes the play so powerful, because it is timely and it is also timeless, because there is also the element of these two human beings being in a room alone together, wrestling with the human condition. And I think that Rick is the everyman in some way, where perhaps the seed of evil is planted in all of us somewhere. And he sees himself as just someone who has felt oppressed and unheard and impotent and unable to give voice to his own concerns, and finds himself part of this large machine that he felt was going to do good, but unravels out of control. And it really asks the fundamental question of when is it time to say no? And that's the question that glorious character constantly asks Rick. Why didn't you stand up and say no. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Rick has all of his reasons why, my family, my responsibility, the guys that were working for me. But he's a human being caught in this large machine.
He's a perfect example of the Milgram experiment that we were talking about.
The Milgram experiment? Go ahead. What is it?
The idea that a regular, ordinary human being who has a family and children and goes to work every day and performs horrible atrocities and is just and will follow orders, will follow authority, even if it means hurting another mm-hmm. human being because they're afraid of losing their job or because they're just a regular guy and they're caught up in that system and they're just going to follow directions.
Yeah, it's really important to me that audiences understand that this play is not just a political statement against the current administration, that it's about much more than that. And it's about the human condition and what it is to be a human being. Yeah. And it's about personal responsibility and accountability.
Now, I find myself sympathizing with him. I mean, I have to. I mean, I understand his plight. I have to understand where he's coming from.
Yeah, because
Well, I think that's the problem. I think that
when
maybe
when you say no, when you stand up,
right?
And mm-hmm. For those of us who are on the left side of the aisle, who are have political left leanings, I think that this Rick personifies the person who put Trump into the White House. In that he is forgotten, he feels forgotten, and he just, like so many of the Trump supporters, wanted someone to say, we're important and do something for us. I think, unfortunately, we weren't really hearing those people, that there are a lot of people in the country
and the irony being that
who are really suffering now. And we are all in the same boat. That's the problem, that we haven't found a way for us to all realize that we have these commonalities. And that's what's so lovely about the play. Like what Stephen's saying, it's really a play about two people who would never be in the same situation, in the same room, who are forced to sit down and talk to each other
right.
for an hour and a half. And it's an extraordinary play where two people are actually talking and listening to each other and learning something about the other person.
Okay, let me say this, though. Now, first I have to tell people, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And I'm talking today with actors Beau Foxworth and Judith Moreland, director Michael Michetti, and co-producer Stephen Sacks of the important new play by Robert Schenken called Building the Wall. Now, Building the Wall is playing at the Fountain Theater in Los Angeles, where I saw it. But through the National New Play Network, it will be having a rolling premiere in at least 5 other cities around the U.S., including Washington, D.C. And you can get this to play in your city very, very easy. For more information and to find a performance near you or to find out how you can organize a performance where you live, contact the National New Play Network at nnpn.org. Once again, that's nnpn.org.
There is, I mean, it's something that's really of these times and for these times, which I think is extremely important. But I did want to say one thing in relation to all this, which is that, you know, there was a point in Germany where there was actually the good Germans that they talked about. And the good Germans never thought they did anything wrong. They were getting screwed. You know, hey, we had World War I, and we just lost everything, you know? And I don't know if you ever saw that. Did you ever see that movie Max? It was about Hitler as an artist. And John Cusack is a guy, he lost his arm in World War I, and he's an art dealer and promoter, and he runs into Hitler, and he's doing this thing of, like, you know, he's looking at Hitler's paintings, and they're all the fascistic, you know, eagles and stuff, but he's telling him, hey, you can be an artist. And then all of a sudden, he makes a final meeting for Hitler. Hitler's sitting in a beer hall, and Cusack doesn't make it for whatever reason. In case somebody's going to go out and get this movie, Cusack doesn't make it for whatever reasons. And Hitler says, well, screw this. He goes off and becomes, you know, Adolf Hitler the Nazi. But the thing is that there is a lot of this stuff where for a lot of people, very few Germans actually recognize the fundamental horror and illegitimacy of what's going on. You know, nobody ever challenged, and this is a stunning fact, no one ever challenged in Germany the legitimacy of the Hitler regime, of the Hitler government. They never challenged it. They never said this wasn't legitimate. You know, there were people who stood up against it, but, you know, but even then, they weren't that many. People went along because, yes, they felt like they got screwed, but morally and politically and every other way you can think of it, involves being a decent human being, they were really wrong, you know, and they needed to do something. They needed to break with that. That's what I felt with your character, because I do have to say, your character, you know, Beau, your character is really, you bring a certain amount of sympathy towards this character. You know, I'm not saying you have sympathy, but, you know, I'm saying you bring a certain amount of sympathetic feeling towards this character. But the audience has to catch itself, I think, to a certain extent, and say, wait a minute,
there's something, and see, we're not going to get into what actually rolls out towards the end of the play, but there is a point where people have to make this decision. Nonetheless, this person is doing stuff that is heinous, you know, and we can't close our eyes to that, you know, so.
That we also have to have the moral strength to stand up to authority figures and say, no, this is wrong. I can't do that.
Right, including people like your character, exactly.
Yes.
Your character, exactly. And look, quite frankly, in this society today, there's a lot more people who are out there saying that damn immigrants are taking my job or the blacks are taking my jobs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And actually, people need to say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. And they need to stand up against the stand in the right direction, basically, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
Well, that's part of the journey of the play, I think, for the audience with the character of Rick. I think when we first see him, he's in a prison orange jumpsuit, and he's a white Southern male and a Trump supporter, and I think we have certain preconceived ideas about him.
Talks a certain way.
Yeah, exactly. Says some things. But through the journey of the play, you realize that there's a real human being there. Mm-hmm. And if you may not sympathize, at least you understand him, which is the journey.
You know, I have a feeling we should have done the entire hour on this because we're just getting so close. But I am going to have Robert come in and talk on the phone and talk about this as well. Yeah, yeah. But I also wanted to, you know, there's something that he wrote where he said, you know, in the writer's notes, he said, if you don't pay attention, the unimaginable can become the inevitable. And that actually, to me, is something that's really important in this, because the unimaginable can become the inevitable. And that's what I think
it
actually
has.
Yeah, yeah, that's what's happening right now in our country.
We're on that path right now.
Absolutely. There you go. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I think that's important. But Steve, there's one other thing I wanted to talk with you about.
Okay.
And Michael, I meant to have you come in, but you've been doing a good job of coming in. But there's a whole way that this rolled out, which I thought was very significant. And I want people to understand, again, you alluded to it in the beginning, but I think it's actually important for people to understand, one, you jumped on this the moment you heard about it, but then you also were part of a whole staging, a whole way that this would move out and roll across the country and reach all these places. And I'm seeing, you know, a theater in Silver Spring that I used to go to and stuff, you know, that is now putting this stuff on in D.C. And then, you know, all over the country there's things. And then I guess there's hope for more people coming into it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Robert sent me the play in December. I asked to read it. He sent it to me immediately. I read it and said, we have to do this play. We already had our season in place, but because we very much wanted to add our voice to the outcry that was against what was happening in our country, I wanted the Fountain Theater to make a statement with this play. So we moved the play that was scheduled out and put this play in. And also, the Fountain Theater is a member of the National New Play Network, which is a national organization of theaters around the country that are dedicated to developing and producing new plays. And so we have organized a rolling world premiere in which this play, after it opens in Los Angeles, another production opens in Denver, and then it will open in Washington, D.C., in Tucson, Arizona, and Miami. I'm very excited about the Forum Theater production opening in Washington, D.C. at Arena Stage later in April. So that will put the play just 2 miles away from the White House.
Yeah, that's what I was happy
about. So I'm hoping that we're going to get a tweet about our play, which would be the best review we could possibly get.
And post that sucker up.
That's right. Can't get better publicity than that.
Please call us overrated, Donald Trump.
That's right. Fake theater.
Well, fake theater.
Well, closing. I wanted to thank all of you for this and for what you've done with this. And, you know, it is incredible. I do think that there's the point about the unimaginable becoming the inevitable, but also the way that this unfolds and shows people that you can go from, even if you're not remaining cognizant of what's actually happening and what the outcome of things that you do and say, if you're not actually paying attention to that tremendous, horrible evil can be unleashed in the world and has been and will continue to be, you know. And it's interesting because I was just thinking as we were talking, I saw this film, I can't remember the name of it now, but it was a documentary on Indonesia. And all these people who had slaughtered, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, they had slaughtered hundreds of thousands of communists. I mean, the rivers in Indonesia actually turned red. And what happened was these guys were like laughing about and talking about the horrific things that they did to people. And you're saying this, and then that sort of came up on me after seeing the play and seeing that, you know, because there's a certain amount of the banality of evil, you know, and there's a certain amount. And even those people who are saying, well, I'm getting screwed, so I'm just going to do this. It involves a certain amount of embracing the banality of evil, you know, and sort of that to me is a really heavy scene. So thank you guys very much for putting on the play and for coming in, and let's do more of this.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah,
very
exist.
Much.
Now look, my memory is failing, okay, but so I'm gonna have to sit here and say, and I just lost the sheet. Okay.
Anyway, I want to thank all of you for coming in today.
Okay? You're welcome. Thank you for having
us. All right. I found it. Okay. Beau Foxworth. See, I have to get the names exactly right. Yeah. Judith Moreland, who we spoke afterwards at the party there. He had some very interesting things to say there, too. And Michael Michetti. I grew up in South Philadelphia. You would think that I And Stephen Sachs, who I always enjoy seeing and talking with. So, Stephen.
Absolutely.
All right. So, thank you again very much.
Mm-hmm. A pleasure.
Right, thank
take
you.
Care now. Thank you.
We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back. So, stay tuned.
The pledge to resist. We believe that as a people living in the United States, it is our responsibility to resist the injustices done by our government in our names. Not in our name will you wage endless war. There can be no more deaths, no more transfusions of blood for oil. Not in our name will you invade countries, bomb civilians, kill more children, letting history take its course over the graves of the nameless. Not in our names will you erode the very freedoms you have claimed to fight for. Not by our hands will we supply weapons and funding for the annihilation of families on foreign soil. Not by our mouths will we let fear silence us. Not by our hearts will we allow whole peoples or countries to be deemed evil. Not by our will and not in our name. We pledge resistance. We pledge alliance with those who have undergone attack for voicing opposition to the war or for their religion or ethnicity. We pledge to make common cause with the people of the world to bring about justice, freedom, and peace. Another world is possible, and we pledge to make it real.
All right, welcome back. That was Saul Williams and DJ Spooky from, oh man, maybe 15 years ago, but so damn relevant today, all right? And so important. And it's called Not In Our Name, all right? And I'm really pleased to actually getting a chance to talk with my next guest. His name is Juan Dimitrix, and he's from Concerned Students 1867 at Howard University. And Howard University students are protesting the university's collaborating with and sucking up to Donald Trump, all right? And so let's just bring Dimitrix on right away. Dimitrix, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Let's jump into this. In early to mid-February, Howard University, one of the historic black universities in the U.S., erupted in struggle around the university and its relationship to the fascist Trump regime. Tell people what happened.
Right, so basically, before even Betsy DeVos came to our campus, we kind of got the word through a plug on campus that somebody from Trump's administration, either Trump himself or one of his cabinet members, was going to be coming to the university. And I guess we didn't think that would be appropriate, knowing what the administration stands for. So in order to protect our safe space, we started to organize and plan our next action to how we would go about letting our university know that this was not a good thing for them to do. So as far as that, we were planning before Betsy DeVos came, then Betsy DeVos showed up. We didn't get any word from our university that she was showing up. We didn't get any word that she was here or that she came until after, through the media outlets, that they told us, I think it was HBCU Buzz or HBCU BuzzFeed or something like that. But yeah, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm.
So she came and basically, we drafted out a full list of demands of how we want to maintain our safe space as black students at Howard University during this Trump administration and resist during this Trump administration. So we drafted out 6 demands, and basically we've been going since then.
Okay, well, let's tell people the demands, because I like them. Okay, I like them. I want people to hear them.
You like them?
Yeah, I like them, man.
All right, cool. The first one we got is declare Howard University a sanctuary campus. People don't know, but we have many undocumented students here and many immigrant students here. So, like, Trump's immigration ban affects us as well. And then the way he feels towards immigrants, maybe not all of the immigrants that we have here are Muslim, but the way he feels towards immigrants is going to affect us in the near future. Like, if you have the foresight, you can understand this. So we want to make Howard University a sanctuary campus. When ICE comes onto this campus, we don't want our university discussing immigration status with the Immigration Customs Enforcement. We don't want them to provide any basically any type of information about those immigrant or undocumented students. We also want, in the case that they are arrested or gotten by ICE, we want our university to provide legal support and distance learning options and stuff of that nature. Before, we didn't want Donald Trump on this campus, but our president has already said that he doesn't really have the intention of inviting Donald Trump on this campus. Before, he said he did because he thought it would be appropriate for us to engage and critique Donald Trump. But if we know Donald Trump, we know that Donald Trump does not care about who engages and critiques him. He doesn't care about how you feel about him. He's just going to talk over you the entire time. So I don't know how that would be something that we could do. But recently he said Donald Trump's not going to be invited to this campus. The third one, we didn't want financial support from the new administration. We didn't want additional funds if it was going to come with stipulations on our campus. So historically, we've always known that whenever we accept money from a white supremacist government, as black people, it always comes with more stipulations on or say on how we run our lives and how we operate. So we basically just didn't want any of that. And that was coming from the HBCU executive order. But as we know, no funds came with that executive order. Really, they just took the any funds that were going to be coming or any type of things that were going to be happening with HBCUs. They just transferred it from being in the Department of Education, and now it's under Donald Trump's watch. The fourth demand, we wanted more visibility and more resources for underrepresented groups such as immigrants, LGBTQIA, and the Muslim populations and things of that nature. We have a lot of those people here. The fifth demand, we wanted a Kwame Ture Community Center so that we can bridge the gap or restore the connection between the local community and the Howard community, because it's a very schismatic relationship right now. I think most of that comes from the elitism at Howard and the basically black bourgeois nature of Howard students and just Howard faculty and things and other things like that. So lastly, we wanted our president to say that he was committed to black liberation. And of course, as an HBCU and as an HBCU president, you would expect that he would say that. So we just want to know that when he gets into these meetings with these higher ups, we can trust that he's going to speak on our behalf. And we can trust that he's going to represent us in the best fashion possible. So,
let me ask you this, Juan. There's a question here. You know, something I read that I thought was really important, where a lot of the exchange between the officials at the university and the students and you guys, that there was this whole question of raising the fact that the university raising the fact that there was a question of, we need the money that we'll get from all this. We need the money that will come in from this. You know, there's a lot of donors. There's things. You know, money that we can get from Trump, we can get from the government. And there was they're basically saying that in exchange for money, they're willing to sell the soul of the university. And I thought your response to that was actually pretty heavy and pretty important and sharp. Can you tell people about that?
Yes, definitely. We're in a very unique position as an HBCU, and as HBCUs all over the country, us being basically the space for higher education for black youth and marginalized groups. We have to operate as a business, which schools usually do, but we also have to uphold the standards and the morals and the values of black culture and of black resistance in this country. So when he says that we need the money, so maybe we should, cooperate or just let them step on us for a little while just so we can get this money. Okay, but how much do we really have to dance, and how many casualties, what casualties are we willing to risk for the extra money? And to make this known, this was before the HBCU executive order, because we know subsequently that we didn't get any money. So all that really dancing and tap dancing and backflipping that you did for Trump's administration, not just our president, but presidents across HBCUs, you know what I'm saying, it didn't really come out of anything. We didn't get any money. All we got was a photo op. They weren't even allowed to talk for more than 7 minutes about the universities and what the universities need. So, like I said before, you can never critique and engage Donald Trump because he does not care. He's not going to listen. He really just wants to talk to you, tell you his plans, and wants to let you know how he's going to use you. Mm-hmm. So basically, yeah, I would never sell my soul as a black person for any extra nominal freedom. You know, I would never give my name. I would never rid myself of my values. I would always stand firm in truth and service, which is something that our university believes in. That's our maxim, truth and service. With everything, we stand in truth and service. So as the students, when we hear that, when that's beaten to our brains from the day that we get here, we expect the person who represents us the most to also adhere to those values. So when he was going and having these secret meetings and going and meeting with Donald Trump, and we didn't trust that he was going to speak well on our behalf. That's him not standing in truth and service. And that's him going against the values of HBCUs and the values of Black people and the values of humanity in general. Mm-hmm. So,
let me ask you this. I wanted to know if you had heard from any of the other students at HBCUs, at the historically Black college and universities. Have you heard anything from them or from other Black students in other universities?
Of course. We have a deep connection with many HBCUs, especially down in the AUC, the Atlanta district. So we're very well connected. This isn't just something that's unique to this region. This is a problem and an issue that's traversing every region where there's an HBCU in America. And this is a problem that's traversing really national boundaries. So if we can get connections to international students, that'd be dope as well. But we're not in this alone. And they've shown their solidarity and support, and we support them in all that they do. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me this, and we're running low on our time, but I wanted to know, you had an event, actually, on March 2nd. It was a Howard convocation, and I understand you disrupted that. And I wanted you to tell people the response that got.
It was really a divided response. During convocation, I guess we disrupted for at least, not even 5 minutes, about 2 minutes, where we just stood up and we let people know not what the demands were, per se, but what we expected from Wayne Frederick, my comrade. She said, we just expect you to choose us in this moment. We want you to choose us. And the response was from both older and younger generations. Some people felt that we had been rude and disrupted the whole service, and other people were proud that we did what we did.
Yeah, I actually read where you got kind of an ovation as you got out, that a lot of people stood up and cheered you, because I think it's extremely important to actually go in there and to say these kinds of things, to confront them at every move, every time they turn up, you know, because you can't emphasize enough the importance of struggles like this going on campuses right now.
Of course. We got a standing ovation, but like I said, some people were not very happy with what we were doing. They were disconcerted. They thought we were rude. When they walked out, we tried to talk to people and let them know what we were doing. Hey, we're HU Resistance. Some folks just said, no, I don't like y'all. Go away. So, you know, it's that division, but we're still rocking with the student body, so it's all good.
All right. And you got to keep us informed, man. And the response you've gotten across the country has been supportive?
Somewhat, yeah. Like I said, it's always going to be that division in the way people respond to these types of things. Like, not everybody's on the same wave. Some people thought our demands were too radical. Me personally, I don't think they're radical enough. But, you know, that's just me. So.
All right, Juan, we're going to have to stop now, but I want to thank you very much, and we'll stay in touch, man. All right?
All right.
All right, cool. All right. Thank you very much.
All right.
All right, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Juan Dimitrix, a concerned student's 1867 at Howard University, and they're protesting the university's collaboration with and sucking up to Donald Trump, okay? And including the university president, who apparently has Wayne Frederick, who has apparently been doing quite a bit of sucking up to him, all right? We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
What good?
All right, welcome back. That was Troubled Times by Green Day. Right now, I'm very pleased to welcome into the show Luna.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
And good, how are you?
Luna's part of the Revolution Club in L.A.?
Yes.
And you also work with Refuse Fascism, right?
Yes.
Yeah, good, cool. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right.
Glad to be here.
Now I got a bunch of questions for you. I'm going to grill you.
Okay. I'm ready.
All right. You're a member of the Revolution Club. You work with Refuse Fascism. As I understand it, you've been a part of a movement to make UCLA a sanctuary campus.
Yes.
What's the situation in UCLA? And then we'll talk about what it means to be a sanctuary campus.
Okay, well, the situation right now on campus, I had gone, I think it was maybe a couple weeks ago, to a town hall meeting that some of the different coalitions of student organizations on campus for undocumented students, you had like YDS, put it together, and a lot of students came out, and they made a list of demands to present to Chancellor Block, which is the chancellor of UCLA. to make a sanctuary campus. But they did kind of say that, you know, these are symbolic. And then they took the demands to his office and they read them out. And obviously he didn't come out. Like, he's not, like, he didn't come out, but they said that we'll be back. And everyone kind of went in and was chanting, and it was really cool, and it was something really good to unite with. But then you had a couple students, as well as a friend of mine who's also part of the Revolution Club and Refuse Fascism, say that as creating a list of demands is good, and we should be uniting with that as students and as creating this culture of resistance, not only on campus, but everywhere. But there's students who put out there, like, what is, yeah, like you were saying, what does it mean to create a sanctuary campus? And are we willing to put our bodies on the line to make sure that these ICE vans and these ICE raids are nowhere near UCLA or nowhere near, or just if you are willing to, blocking those vans from coming, from taking people away, like you can see in what happened in Arizona.
And talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, there was a young boy in Arizona who put his arm through the tire rim so that the ICE van couldn't leave. Unfortunately, she's still the woman he was trying to block from being taken away. She still got deported. But I think that that kind of resistance is what's needed on campuses as well as throughout everywhere that these raids are going on. And I think that's what's needed.
I understand that UCLA has a huge number of undocumented people.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of undocumented students right now who are afraid. You know, I have a lot of friends who are undocumented, and they tell me how agonized they are and the fear that they have about this fascist agenda, because calling Trump a fascist, it's not an insult. It's not like, okay, he's a fascist. Like, it's not name calling here. It's actually these mass deportations, not only of students, but of people all around the country who do minor crimes and labeling them as criminals and rapists. This is part of the fascist program of this ethnic cleansing of not making America great again, but making America white again. And all of those illusions of American chauvinism that many people have, which are not true.
Mm-hmm. How do you see fighting to actually establish this? What's it going to take to actually establish this?
Well, to establish a sanctuary campus and a sanctuary city and overall a sanctuary state, like I said before, yeah, putting your bodies on the line and while also building momentum to drive them from power, to create a political crisis out here. And students are important and a super important part of that, because historically students have been in front of the anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, all of that. And campuses, they allow critical thinking and intellectual thinking and dissent. So students need to be there. They're important. And putting your bodies on the line and not letting ICE take people away is commensurate to what we're facing right now. And it also will inspire more people to do the same and to say, well, if these students can do it, or if these students are blocking ICE from taking people away, then I can do it too. And then if ICE isn't able to take undocumented people away, I guess, what does that say about this whole regime? Like, or just all of these mass deportations of which are illegitimate.
Well, let's dig into this a little bit more, like how you see the relationship between this and driving out the Trump-Pence regime, because it's really, I think it's an important thing for people to understand. You know, it's like, it's not just that these things are happening the same as they were happening under Obama, the same as they were happening under, you know, whoever, that there's under Bush or whoever, there's actually something here in terms of the need to actually drive out this regime. And I want to talk a little bit more about how you see the connection between those two.
I see the connection between these two. Well, Donald Trump, when we talk about fascism, he is openly, you know, saying that he wants to deport people, and driving them from power and having people physically block ICE vans from taking people away. It builds momentum. It builds momentum where you can have millions of people in the street saying no to everything, like all of these protests at LAX against the Muslim ban and after the inauguration of the Women's Day March, all of those are building momentum and are what's needed. And they're protesting every outrage, but we need to be going further and being out in the streets and staying in the streets. And part of staying in the streets is, you know, being in the streets, literally physically blocking those ICE raids. And that is part of that. And that is part of, like, encouraging and motivating millions and millions of people to see this as commensurate and to see this as necessary in confronting a fascist regime and all of these attacks on immigrants and undocumented people.
Yeah, it is very important that people actually do see this as a fascist regime. And there's a lot of struggle around that right now. And it's, it's sort of, and what does that, when you understand that, what does that actually call on you to do, which is what I think you're talking to, which is very, very important, and doing it in across society and looking at it. It is the regime. It's not just this university here or this incident here or whatever, but there's actually, there is this regime that is a fascist regime that is implementing fascism, as you said. Let's talk a little bit about how you see, and you started to talk about this, but we have about 4 minutes left and I wanted to try
and think.
Let's talk a little bit about how you see the importance of students in all this and in the world today.
Well, the importance of students, like I said before, students have been an integral part of different movements historically. And the university, whether you're an intellectual or an academic, the university allows this kind of critical thinking, which Donald Trump himself is not a fan of. Anyone who opposes...
What?
Yeah, obviously. He's not a fan of critical thinking. He's not a fan of people criticizing his program and calling them fake news, all of this, and having, you know, disregard for dissent or having disregard for the arts. You can see, like, that whole parallel between the way Hitler kind of went around calling artists and intellectuals degenerate. And that kind of sentiment is what Donald Trump has as well. And why it is important for students to resist that and to be a part of the resistance all over the country and to build resistance because they're an important part of it.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting too, because they do actually, students actually, you think about some, in some ways, some of the way that students are actually, look, there's actually a lot of, one, they have a lot of freedom to do a lot of things to a certain extent, but then also there's a certain thing that they bring into it, as you're saying. And I think it actually, it points to something I've been thinking about a lot. And this isn't so much a question as a comment. You can comment on it, you know, when I'm done. But but I mean, the basic point is that I look at the universities and there is an assault. There's an assault on students. There's an assault on the, you know, as we're talking about immigrants at the universities and in society at large. There's also an assault on the whole idea of these universities and what these universities are, you know, and because, you know, universities have often have, as you said, they've provided a home base for a lot of the movements that began in the past. They also provide, I mean, look, universities that engage in critical thinking and examining things and developing all this. And there's all this kind of stuff that goes on in these universities where they aren't afraid to challenge things. They actually, that's part of what happens with them.
Right.
And in the face of these fascists, that's a dangerous thing. So when you see, you know, when people see that, it's like, actually, yeah, that's something about the universities themselves coming under attack, as well as the students within the universities and the undocumented people you're talking about. And the importance of actually the students taking a stand and actually making the campus an ICE-free zone,
right.
You know, which is
yeah.
very, very important.
Yeah, making that real, not just symbolic, making it an actual thing, making it tangible. And also, you know, I encourage anyone who is listening, if you're a student or whoever, to join, like, email us at refusefascism@gmail.com as well as refusefascism_UCLA@gmail.com. And to be...
Say them again very slow.
Okay, sorry. refusefascism@gmail.com and refusefascism_UCLA@gmail.com.
Okay.
Yeah, like you were saying, just calling on students and professors to make their campuses a fascist-free zone, to not tolerate not only these deportations, but to not tolerate misogyny, not tolerate white supremacy, not tolerate anything that Trump is doing and spreading this no and saying no to all of it everywhere.
All right, Luna, we're going to have to wrap up, unfortunately, but I'm really pleased that you came in today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I want to thank everybody who was on the show today, all right? I want to thank the cast, the director, and the co-producer of the play, Building the Wall. I want to thank Juan Dimitrix for calling in from Howard University, and I want to thank Luna again, all right, and for coming in and talking with us about this. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today. Yes, I got it. I couldn't miss. I was going to build a whole big thing. Kiana Williams! All right. And I'm Michael Slate, and we will be back next week. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right. And I'm not quite sure. Oh, we're going out with a decision from Outer National. All right. So check this out.
You hate this while you're waiting for a cure. Decision.